You're listening to Scopes Monkey Choir. Music in a rational universe.
Hello and welcome to Scopes Monkey Choir.
Music in a rational universe.
This is episode 10.
Bum, 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 bum.
Is that an anniversary? Why are we so wrapped up in, like, round numbers, I think?
I don't know, but I have noticed that this turn of the year, I've been seeing a lot of people complaining about that on blogs and everything. Everyone's saying, well, everyone's always, what are these numbers? What's the...
It's only that it's 2011 and we're living in the future.
Right. In the future, future. So we're still a little bit in... The hog of holidays.
In other words, we're totally hungover. It is January 1st, and we are the only people working on this day.
Yeah. So this is going to be a small episode. We're just going to talk about a couple things, and then we're going to play an interview we did.
All I can say is cats in space.
Cats in space. That's the plan. So, yeah, one news item, pretty small, but it's an excuse to make noises. In 2001, in Peru, 23,000-year-old conch shells that were highly decorated and with a mouthpiece so it could be played were found.
Wow, that was a really big separation from the subject to the verb of that sentence.
That's because my mind is so big that I can... No, it's because I didn't... think about what I was going to say before I spoke. some scientists were interested about the acoustic properties of it, of these shells. So they tested them and they put tiny microphones in different places. For instance, in the player's mouth, and then in the entrance to the shell, and then also in the exit of the shell, and then I think one in the main chamber. They stuck one way in there. And what's sort of interesting is that when they play them, and using those by analyzing those sound files and examining the acoustic properties of each instrument, they could actually rebuild the shape of the interior of the shell. So they could figure out exactly the interior shape of each shell without cutting it in half.
Oh, so they were kind of using sonar in a sort of reflected sound.
Well, in the article I read, it doesn't get too clear about exactly how they reconstructed it. Whether
they probably know these things. We're going to have to find one of them to talk to, those acousticians.
We're coming for you, acousticians. Anyway, as I said, it's all just an excuse to play a conch shell sound, which.
Excuse you.
Yeah.
That's someone actually playing a 23,000-year-old...
No, 3,000.
Oh, excuse me. I believe you said 23,000 in your...
No, it was 23,000-year-old.
Oh, that was good. Okay, so they found 20 conch shells, and they are 3,000 years old, every single one of them. Oh my gosh, that's an amazing way to ring in the new year.
Isn't that pretty? So pretty.
Way better than those stupid piece of crap noisemakers.
Yeah, so Strombus galateus. No, galateus. Why did I just say that? That's the scientific name of the
for
conscious.
A noisemaker?
No, yes, for that noisemaker.
Oh, are they significantly different from contemporary conch shells?
Well, I believe that this species is still around, if that's what you mean. But there are a lot of different, like conch is actually a pretty broad term. There, conch can refer to animals in the Strombus
genus,
thank you. But it also can refer to other large shelled creatures, you know, because conch is not a scientific term, but a informal.
An informal term for what? For a large spiraled shell that you cut a hole in and blow?
Pretty much. You can eat them, too.
I mean, you can, because they can be conch without being trumpets.
You don't have to blow them. You can chew them.
Right.
But yeah, they work on the trumpet style instrument where you buzz your lips.
Right, and people still use them today to make instruments. Yeah, exactly.
Well, and that's what's the ram's horn too is the same kind of thing, right?
The shofar.
The shofar. It's the same.
The shofar.
Shofar. I don't know.
Shofar. yes. No. I just mean. I guess I was in a roundabout way asking whether there's something particular about these 3,000-year-old shells that they were puzzled about, or that was seen particularly different.
Gave them a reason to examine it so carefully. Yes, and exactly. Yeah, you know, I don't know, and I tell you the truth, couldn't figure out exactly what. I mean, you know, they could just get any conch shell and blow it, and that's pretty much what it would sound like. But
yeah, although they do sound to me maybe sweeter or something than how I think of a conch shell sounding.
Yeah, well, they said that the mouth holes that were made were really very well crafted, so I'm sure that would make a big difference.
Cool.
So, and there's another thing I wanted to mention. It's not really news, but came up on my radar via the Take As Directed blog. He did a little remembrance of John Denver, the singer-songwriter, who his birthday would have been December 31st had he not croaked. In case you don't know who John Denver is, he wrote a lot of famous late 60s and 70s folky tunes like Leaving on a Jet Plane, Take Me Home, Country Roads, Rocky Mountain High, Sunshine on My Shoulders, Thank God I'm a Country Boy, etc. And I have to be perfectly honest, which is that I spent most of my life hating John Denver's music. I found it interesting because it turns out that John Denver was a real science, pro-science guy. Hmm. And in fact, to thank him for his sort of science popularizing, not popularizing, but science, what's the term when you're not a science popularizer, but you are pro-science in public?
Promotion of science?
Promotion of science, yeah. And specifically in the space program, he actually was, NASA awarded him one of their public service medals.
Oh.
And this same blog post pointed me to a nice YouTube clip, which was apparently John Denver used to sit in for Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show sometimes. And so there's a nice clip of John Denver interviewing Carl Sagan in 77. And it's really kind of nice because his enthusiasm is really like totally on display. He's just like obviously geeking out in front of Carl Sagan, as we all would. So that's just a little mention that John Denver, who is... All right, I won't insult him directly.
He wrote some good songs. Come on.
He did write some good... I like Rocky Mountain High. He's just kind of... Well, you remember when we were on that...
I was just going to ask you about that tour of that ranch in
Wyoming.
Jackson Hole, Wyoming, whose name I can't remember now.
We were on tour in this ranch, and the person who was showing us around pressed play on a CD player and said, "And here's a song that Harrison Ford wrote."
Yes, yeah, so he said, and Harrison Ford was a great supporter of the naturalists who lived here on this ranch and made this science school. And he kept referring to John Denver as Harrison Ford.
Yeah.
And so I didn't hear anything else he said because I was giggling about that and trying to figure out how he possibly could have mixed up Harrison Ford and John Denver.
Yeah. All right. Well, so before we play the interview, we just wanted to become a holiday tradition. To listen to the Messiah Organist on crack. Now, I know this sound clip has been around for years. Most of you have probably heard it, but maybe some of you haven't. But for us personally, we never get sick of it.
No, tis the season for Messiah.
Tis the season. So, what do you want to do? You want to talk about it a little bit?
Well, you better play it, because you can never hear it too often.
All right, here's the Messiah Organist on crack.
Thank you.
Oh, I hadn't heard that yet this season. It is so great.
Oh, what a great one.
So,
So forgive us for, you know,
no one going back a few days. Wait, no, you know, yeah. Messiah is being performed, is still being performed all through this season.
Oh, really?
I'm still singing choruses from it. I believe I'm singing two of them this Sunday in church. It goes on. Actually, Handel's Messiah was not originally specific to the Christmas season. It just has become
more of an Easter
traditional.
Thing, right?
Well, it is not specific to any season. The text itself is just kind of it's a non-narrative overview of the kind of high points of Jesus Christ and the
seven dwarves.
Oh, yes, that's what that book is called. Of the kind of, not the life of Jesus, as I said, is non-narrative, not the life of Jesus, but the high points of Christianity,
right,
as taken from the Bible. Exactly.
Yeah.
And they are, it's sort of in three parts that are kind of like birth.
Nah, whatever. But
anyway, so the Hallelujah chorus. So this Hallelujah chorus may or may not be meant for the Easter part. After Jesus Christ is risen from the dead, hallelujah. The text is from Revelation, so it's completely nonsensical anyway, but it says hallelujah and he's the King of Kings. But we think we know what happened with this incredible excerpt that has been called Messiah Organist on Crack. I'm sure the Messiah Organist was not on crack. Well, I'm not sure. But the deal is that organs, of course, have stops. This is for those of you who are not musicians. We've had some requests recently from people who are non-musicians to explain some of the terms that we use. So bear with us and giggle over our inaccuracies if you are a musician or an organist. Organs have what are called stops, which are basically pistons that you pull out in order to activate different sets of pipes. And they're labeled on the front of them with what kind of pipe will be activated. They activate whole ranks of pipes, so a certain sound goes on is activated on the keyboard when you pull out a stop.
And which is where the term pull out all the stops comes from.
Exactly, that would mean to activate all of the pipes, and also where the old joke, why did Bach have so many children?
Why?
Because his organ didn't have any stops. Yeah, that's where that comes from. So on modern organs, which are, of course, no longer... No one's pumping bellows to put air through them.
Children. The children used to pump the bellows.
That's true. They did. They had little slave children chained. No. Right. So now they just replaced... Most electronic organs or organs that are part electronic and part air have replaced the stops with... There's some kind of switch inside the stop. Sometimes they still look like a piston that you pull out so that organists feel like they're still playing an organ. Sometimes they just look like switches that you press. And electronic organs also often have switches that transpose the whole keyboard to a new key.
Like putting a capo on a guitar.
Exactly.
You just can play do the same
capo.
Hand movements, but... You'll hear different notes.
And as you're going through a piece, especially something like the Hallelujah Chorus, you gradually start pulling out more and more stops to make the organ louder, more vibrant, to change the sound as you go through the piece. And there would definitely be a change of an added stop at this very point at the end of the chorus so that the last chord was the loudest thing ever. And if your finger hit the transpose button instead of the add another stop button, you Oops. Get this result.
Yes.
Let's play it again.
So let's go on to the interview.
All right, that's enough silliness.
And so this is an interview we did the other day with the marvelous Sandy Antunes, who's putting a satellite up into space. He'll tell you about it.
It does not. He's not putting a kitten in space.
He's not? Didn't he prom?
No, that picture, in that picture.
Oh, that's right, the kitty. Oh, we'll post
yeah,
that picture.
Yeah, the cat is just a cat.
Cat's
that
a cat,
other thing
satellite
in the picture
a satellite.
Is the satellite.
Two different things, much to our disappointment. Anyway, here we go.
Hi, Matt.
Hey, Sandy.
Is this any better? And hi, thing.
Hi, Sandy.
So we actually, on a previous episode, talked a bit about your project. So most of our listeners already know the basics. But just for the sake of people who maybe didn't hear that episode, could you maybe just give a brief overview of Project Calliope?
Certainly. Project Calliope is one mad scientist building a satellite in his basement that will launch next year. And it's going to go up to the ionosphere for about 9 to 12 weeks and convert the edge of space into sound that any musician can reuse as royalty-free tracks, and anyone can listen in to hear what space actually sounds like in terms of its activity and changes and dynamics, because I often feel we don't have a good sense of what space really is.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that there's actually a lot going on up there.
Right. It's alternating periods of boredom and sudden activity.
Uh-huh.
And we have this wonderful thing called an atmosphere that protects us from all the nasty stuff out there. But it's a very interesting environment. The ionosphere is where the auroras happen. And everyone's visually seeing the auroras and like, ooh, ah. Mm-hmm. It'd be nice to tangibly connect that by hearing it in a musical fashion.
Absolutely.
Now, how much of that activity would be categorized as sound if we could actually put a living ear up there?
Almost none of it, because there's almost no air there. It's near vacuum. There's just a thin amount of material, which is what the solar plasma reacts with to cause it, but not enough that we could hear. So sonification is translating detectors into sound so that we can pick it up. And I actually got the idea from a sysadmin tool that someone used called, I'm blank on the name, I think called Ping, that takes the network traffic on a network and converts it to sound. So while the sysadmin is working in their office, they can hear the network in the background. And if they suddenly hear the music ramp up or rev up, they're like, whoa, something's happening to the network.
Oh, cool.
Converting the ionosphere. So you would hear, like hearing the ocean, you hear a steady sort of quiescent background, the occasional crash of waves of mild activity. And if there's suddenly a loud peak of sound, of music, of activity, you're like, wow, that must be a solar event. That sort of thing becomes much more intuitively noticed.
Uh-huh. So, and then my understanding of the ionosphere, which is extremely limited, but I do gather that there are events and such that are described as wavelengths and frequencies and things that could be sort of more or less directly translated into sound. Is that right?
Correct. All that we see, light all the way going up to radio, X-rays, and gamma rays, is the electromagnetic spectrum, and that's energy, that's photons transferring energy. And what we call sound is physical vibration of molecules passing that vibration along until we feel it. So it's translating from photons to sound, essentially.
What sort of sensors are you using to pick up the activity?
I'm using IQBEX sensors from Infusion Systems in Canada, because they make sensors for performance artists and hobbyists.
Ah.
So when you see people doing movement and the movements being translated theremin-like into music, they're often using IQBEX type sensors. And these are small, portable, waterproof, really durable sensors that automatically produce MIDI data, essentially producing sheet music from it. And so I thought they'd be ideal to launch into space. And the Infusion Systems people have been giving me some good tech support to get this to work out. They're a lot of fun, since obviously they straddle the music, science, performance area that we all are working on here.
Wow. So does that mean that that it's actually going to be converted to sound files before it's transmitted back to Earth?
Correct. Anyone with a ham radio would be able to pick up the MIDI files being sent down as digital packets and hook into their computer and listen live to the MIDI tracks from it. And the nice thing about MIDI is you can map it. You can say, oh, okay, let's make the background magnetic field be mapped to heavy organ, and we'll make the daylight sensors be mapped to snare drums, or whatever mapping you want, and come up with interesting things.
Wow, that's very cool.
So one question going back to the beginning, how is Calliope getting into space?
There's a company called Interorbital. Interorbital announced that they're going to send up what I call Pico satellites, these little Coke can-sized satellites, for $8,000, and they'll give you the plans, and that includes the launch. This is about a factor of 10 cheaper than any other way to get into space, and it really puts it down into amateur budgets. My joke is, as far as midlife crises go, I could buy a motorcycle or launch a satellite into space, and which one is cooler?
Obviously, you've picked the cooler.
to me. And the funny thing is, when I talk to people about it, they're like, yep, satellite. I feel sorry for the motorcycle manufacturers, but that's life.
Yeah, well, time marches on. I wanted to go back to the data coming back to Earth. You mentioned that when it's transmitting, that anyone with a ham radio that knows the frequency would be able to hear it or access it. But are you going to have sort of an official collector of some sort that is going to be continually downloading all the data?
Most definitely. I'm going to be talking to my ham friends to basically try and get volunteers that are willing to monitor the satellite for its short many weeks life and give us the Project Calliope data as they gather, and then we'll make a central web repository for it. And that ties in with, I'm still looking for a partner on the music and someone that can help me connect with the musician communities and get this out to people that can then use it and remix it and do interesting stuff.
Yeah, do you want to, a lot of our listeners are either musicians, scientists, both, or just plain geeks. And if you wanted to maybe get into that, it's a little bit, and describe vaguely what you're looking for in that musical collaborator. Some of our listeners may have some ideas.
Well, that would be great. Project Calliope is converting the ionosphere to music. And to get the music out to musicians, I'm going to go with the obvious thought that I need someone that is involved in the musician communities. I'm sort of very on the edge of that sort of thing. And I've talked to a few composers that are interested in it. I've gotten some advice on how to set up a website. But I don't believe in if you build it, they will come. I believe if you build it, you should then tell people that are interested about it so that they can take it and walk away with it. So I'd love to meet people that are in the remix community or the peer-to-peer community or the producing community or who do a music portal or otherwise are already engaging musicians and are part of that dialogue so that they can bring it there. And I also think that gives a better authenticity because they'll be able to state whether this is good or usable, whether it's something that they say, well, this is a novelty, or something like, wow, you could come up with something neat. I'd like to have that rational, critical evaluation from someone who is more into music than just me as an amateur music. The analogy I give is I'm a luthier building a musical instrument in space, and I want musicians to be able to use it.
Well, I think the idea of just getting it out there is half the battle. And I guess what we're doing is working on that. So I have one sort of a silly question, but since this is an audio medium, I like to have some kind of visual reference. Can you tell us what Calliope looks like?
If you go to projectcalliope.com, there are pictures of some of the early builds, and I think my most recent one was talking about trying to ship it. Because I took an early build to my editor in San Francisco when I went to the AGU, and I was very worried about whether the TSA would allow me to ship what's essentially a satellite shell and how that would show up on their X-ray. It ended up being not a problem, but that recent column has a picture of the satellite with a cat next to it for scale.
Excellent.
Yeah, I saw that. Now, it looks like the cat's about to knock it off the bed or whatever it's on. I hope that didn't happen.
This thing has to be able to survive going column of flame while vibration is going to be shaking. It's going to have huge thermal extremes. So if it can't survive a drop test from a cat, we might as well quit right now.
Well, is it true that NASA regularly lets cats loose in their development laboratories just to see if everything can stand up to the cat test?
No, but IKEA did. There's a video of the people releasing their cats in IKEA to show how comfortable things are. It's rather humorous, and it was one of the strangest things I've ever seen.
Thank you very much for your time. It's been great talking to you, and I look forward to hearing what Calliope sends down. Oh, when is it going to be launched?
Currently in spring of 2011, but rocket science is hard, and so Interorbital has to get their first successful burn before we're going to have a date set in stone.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
The more time, the better, is my point of view.
Is it technically ready to be launched at this point, or does it still need work?
No, it is pieces in my basement that still need to be soldered together and integrated. It's definitely a hobbyist's dream, but it's a lot of pieces.
Yeah. All right. So you heard the man. If you have any ideas of someone who might be able to be a good music collaborator with him, or if that person might be you, you can get in touch with him. Go to projectcalliope.com.
And we'll have a link on our site as well.
Of course. Also, when we did that interview with him, it was actually a dual interview, because he also interviewed us about our podcast, because he is one of the contributors to the 365 Days of Astronomy podcast, which is an awesome podcast where various people contribute to have a daily episode about astronomy. I don't know quite how we fit into that, but I'm happy that we will be mentioned, and you should check out that podcast because it is cool. And next week we're going to talk about background music.
Oh my god, isn't it annoying? Aren't you glad we don't have background music on this podcast?
Actually, we're probably going to put the ending theme under this part.
Man, aren't you glad we don't have background music on this podcast?
All right, we're out of here.
Thanks for listening to Scopes Monkey Choir from scopesmonkeychoir.com.
We are professional musicians, but amateur scientists. If you doubt something we've said, don't believe us. Look it up yourself.
Nevertheless, each episode page of scopesmonkeychoir.com has references and citations.
We welcome your feedback. Write to scopesmonkeychoir@gmail.com or call
the monkey phone at 347-788-0330.
And leave a message.